Wow.
What's up?
I just bought and financed a car through Carvana in minutes.
You? The person who agonized 4 weeks over whether to paint your walls eggshell or off-white bought and financed a car in minutes?
They made it easy. Transparent terms, customizable down and monthly. Didn't even have to do any paperwork.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Hey, have you checked out that spreadsheet I sent you for our dinner options?
Finance your car with Carvana and experience total control. Financing subject to credit approval.
Chapter 5 of The Mysterious Stranger by Mark Twain.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Read by Patrick 79.
Chapter 5. On the fourth day comes the astrologer from his crumbling old tower up the valley, where he had heard the news, I reckon. He had a private talk with us, and we told him what we could, for we were mightily in dread of him. He sat there studying, and studying a while to himself. Then he asked,
"How many ducats did you say?"
"Oh, 1,107, sir." Then he said, as if he were talking to himself,
"It is very singular, yes, very strange, a curious coincidence."
Then he began to ask questions and went over the whole ground from the beginning, we answering. By and by he said,
1,106 ducats. It is a large sum."
"Seven," said Seppi, correcting him.
"Oh, seven, was it? Of course a ducat more or less isn't of consequence, but you said 1,106 before."
It would not have been safe for us to say he was mistaken, but we knew he was. Nicholas said,
"We ask pardon for the mistake, but we meant to say seven." "Oh, it is no matter, lad. It was merely that I noticed the discrepancy. It is several days, and you cannot be expected to remember precisely. One is apt to be inexact when there is no particular circumstance to impress the count upon the memory."
"But there was one, sir," said Seppi eagerly.
"What is it, my son?"
asked the astrologer indifferently.
"First, we all counted the piles of coins, each in turn, and all made it the same, 1,106. But I had slipped one out just for fun when the count began, and now I slipped it back and said, 'I think there is a mistake. There are 1,107. Let us count again.' We did, and of course I was right. They were astonished. Then I told how it came about."
"The astrologer asked us if this was so, and we said it was."
"That settles it," he said. "I know the thief now. Lads, the money was stolen."
Then he went away, leaving us very much troubled and wondering what he could mean. In about an hour we found out, for by that time it was all over the village that Father Peter had been arrested for stealing a great sum of money from the astrologer. Everybody's tongue was loose and going. Many said it was not in Father Peter's character, and it must be a mistake. But others, they shook their heads and said misery and want could drive a suffering man to almost anything. About one detail there was no differences. All agreed that Father Peter's account of how the money came into his hands was just about unbelievable. It had such an impossible look. They said it might come into the astrologer's hand in some such way, but into Father Peter's, never. Our characters began to suffer now. we were Father Peter's only witnesses. How much did he probably pay us to back up this fantastic tale? Oh, people talk that kind of talk to us pretty freely and frankly, and were full of scoffings. Then we begged them to believe really we had only told the truth. Our parents were harder on us than anyone else. Our father said we were disgracing our families, and they commanded us to purge ourselves of our lie. And there was no limit to their anger when we continued to say we had spoken true. Oh, our mothers cried over us and begged us to give back our bribe and get back our honest names and save the families from shame and come out and honorably confess. And at last we were so worried and harassed that we tried to tell the whole thing, Satan and all. But no, it wouldn't come out. We were hoping and longing all the time that Satan would come and help us out of our trouble, but there was no sign of him. Within an hour after the astrologer's talk with us, Father Peter was in prison, and the money sealed up in the hands of the officers of the law. The money was in a bag, and Solomon Isaac said he had not touched it since he had counted it. His oath was taken that it was the same money, and that the amount was 1,107 ducats. Father Peter claimed trial by the ecclesiastical court, but our other priest, Father Adolf, said an ecclesiastical court hadn't jurisdiction over a suspended priest. The bishop upheld him, and that settled it. The case was to go to trial in the civil court. The court would not sit for some time to come. William Meadling would be Father Peter's lawyer and do the best he could, of course, but he told us privately that a weak case on his side and all the power and prejudice on the other side, the outlook was bad. So Marget's new happiness died a quick death. No friends came to console with her, and none were expected. An unsigned note withdrew her invitation to the party. There would be no scholars to take lessons. How could she support herself? She could remain in the house, for the mortgage was paid off. Though the government, and not poor Solomon Isaacs, had the mortgage money in its grip for the present. Old Ursula, who was the cook, chambermaid, housekeeper, laundress, and everything else for Father Peter, and had been Margaret's nurse in earlier years, said God would provide. But she said that from habit, for she was a good Christian. She meant to help in the providing, to make sure, if she could find a way. We boys wanted to go and see Margaret and show friendliness for her, but our parents were afraid of offending the community and wouldn't let us. The astrologer was going around inflaming everybody against Father Peter, and saying he was an abandoned thief and had stolen 1,107 ducats from him. He said he knew he was a thief from the fact, for it was exactly the sum he had lost, and which Father Peter pretended to have found. In the afternoon of the fourth day after the catastrophe, old Ursula appeared at our house and asked for some washing to do, and begged my mother to keep the secret, to save Margaret's pride, who would stop this project if she found it out. Yet Margaret had not enough to eat and was growing weak. Ursula was growing weak herself, and she showed it, and she ate off the food that was offered her like a starving person,
but could not be persuaded to carry any home, for Margaret would not eat charity food. She took some clothes down to the stream to wash them, but we saw from the window that handling the bat was too much for her strength. So she was called back, and a trifle of money offered her, which she was afraid to take, lest Margaret should suspect. Then she took it, saying she would explain that she found it in the road. And to keep it from being a lie and damning her soul, she got me to drop it while she watched. Then she went along by there and found it, and exclaimed with surprise and joy, and picked it up and went her way. Like the rest of the village, she could tell everyday lies fast enough, and without taking any precautions against fire and brimstone on their account. But this was a new kind of lie, and it had a dangerous look because she hadn't had any practice in it. After a week's practice, it wouldn't have given her any trouble. Well, it is the way we are made. I was in trouble, for how would Margaret live? Ursula could not find a coin in the road every day, perhaps not even a second one. And I was ashamed, too, for not having been near Margaret, and she so in need of friends. But that was my parents' fault, not mine, and I couldn't help it. I was walking along the path, feeling very downhearted, when a most cheery and tingling, freshening up sensation went rippling through me, and I was too glad for any words, for I knew by that sign that Satan was by. I had noticed it before. Next moment, he was alongside of me, and I was telling him all my trouble and what had been happening to Margaret and her uncle. While we were talking, we turned a curve and saw old Ursula resting in the shade of a tree. And she had a lean, stray kitten in her lap and was petting it. I asked her where she got it, and she said it came out of the woods and it followed her. And she said it probably hadn't any mother or any friends, and she was going to take it home and take care of it. Satan said, I understand you are very poor. Why do you want to add another mouth to feed? Why don't you give it to some rich person? Oh, Ursula bridled at this and said, perhaps you would like to have it. You must be rich with your fine clothes and quality airs. Then she sniffed and said, give it to the rich. The idea! The rich don't care for anybody but themselves. It's only the poor that have the feeling for the poor and help them. The poor God. God will provide for this kitten.
What makes you think so?
Ursula's eyes snapped with anger. Because I know it, she said. Not a sparrow falls to the ground without his seeing it.
But it falls just the same. What good is seeing it fall?
Old Ursula's jaws worked, but she could not get any word out for the moment. She was so horrified. When she got her tongue, she stormed out, oh, go about your business, you puppy, or I will take a stick to you.
I could not speak. I was so scared. I knew that with his notions about the human race, Satan would consider it a matter of no consequence to strike her dead, there being plenty more. But my tongue stood still. I could give her no warning. But nothing happened. Satan remained tranquil. Tranquil and indifferent. I suppose he could not be insulted by Ursula any more than
than the king could be insulted by a tumble-bug.
The old woman jumped to her feet when she made her remark, and did it as briskly as a young girl. It had been many years since she had done the like of that. That was Satan's influence. He was a fresh breeze to the weak and the sick, wherever he came. His presence affected even the lean kitten, and it skipped to the ground and began to chase a leaf. This surprised Ursula, and she stood looking at the creature and nodding her head wonderingly, her anger quite forgotten.
"What's come over it?" she said. "A while ago it could hardly walk."
"You have not seen a kitten of that breed before?" said Satan. Ursula was not proposing to be friendly with a mocking stranger, and she gave him an ungentle look and retorted,
"Who asked you to come here and pester me? I'd like to know. And what do you know about what I've seen and what I haven't seen?"
"You haven't seen a kitten with hair spines on its tongue pointing to the front, have you?"
"No. Nor you, either."
"Well, examine this one and see." Ursula was become pretty spry, but the kitten was spryer, and she could not catch it, and had to give it up. Then Satan said, "Give it a name, and maybe it will come." Ursula tried several times, but the kitten was not interested. "Call it Agnes. Try that." The creature answered to the name and came. Ursula examined its tongue.
"Upon my word, it's true," she said. "I have seen this kind of cat before. Is it yours?"
"No."
"Then how do you know its name so pat?"
"Because all cats of that breed are named Agnes. They will not answer to any other."
Ursula was impressed. "It is a most wonderful thing."
Then a shadow of trouble came into her face, for her superstitions were aroused, and she reluctantly put the creature down, saying,
"I suppose I must let it go. I am not afraid. No, 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 not exactly that, though the priest, well, I've heard people, indeed many people, and besides, it is quite well and now can take care of itself."
She sighed and turned to go, murmuring,
"Oh, it is such a pretty one, too, and would be such company, and the house is so sad and lonesome these days. Miss Marget so mournful and just a shadow. And the old master shut up in jail.
It seems a pity not to keep it," said Satan. Ursula turned quickly, just as if she were hoping someone would encourage her.
"Why?"
she asked wistfully. "Because this breed brings luck."
"Does it?
Is it true?"
"Young man, do you know it to be true? How does it bring luck?"
"Well, it brings money, anyway." Ursula looked disappointed.
"Money? A cat bring money? Oh, the idea. You could never sell it here. People do not buy cats here. One can't even give them away."
And she turned to go. "I don't mean sell it. I mean have an income from it. This kind is called the lucky cat. Its owner finds 4 silver groschen in the pocket every morning." I saw the indignation rising in the old woman's face. Oh, she was insulted. This boy was making fun of her. That was her thought.
She thrust her hands into her pockets and straightened up to give him a piece of her mind. Her temper was all up and hot. Her mouth came open and let out three words of a bitter sentence. Then it fell silent, and the anger in her face turned to surprise, or wonder, or fear, or something, and she slowly brought out her hands from her pocket and opened them and held them so. In one was my piece of money. In the other lay 4 silver groschen. She gazed a little while, perhaps to see if the groschen would vanish away, and then she said fervently, "It's true, it's true, and I'm ashamed and beg forgiveness, our dear master and benefactor." And she ran back to Satan and kissed his hand over and over again, according to the Austrian custom. In her heart, she probably believed it was a witch cat and an agent of the devil. But no matter, it was all the more certain to be able to keep its contract and furnish a daily good living for the family. For in the matters of finance, even the puissest of our peasants would have more confidence in the arrangement with the devil than with an archangel. Ursula started homeward, and Agnes in her arms, and I said I wish I had her privilege of seeing Marget. Then I caught my breath, for we were there in the parlor, and Margaret standing looking at us, astonished. She was feeble and pale, but I knew that those conditions would not last in Satan's atmosphere, and it turned out so. I introduced Satan, that is, Philip Traum, and we sat down and talked. There was no constraint. We were simple folk in our village, and when a stranger was a pleasant person, we were soon friends. Margaret wondered how we got in without her hearing us. Traum said the door was open, and we walked in and waited until she could turn round and greet us. Well, this was not true. No door was open. We entered through the walls, or the roof, or down the chimney, or somehow. But no matter what Satan wished, a person believed. The person was sure to believe, and so Margaret was quite satisfied with that explanation. And then the main part of her mind was on Traum, anyway. She couldn't keep her eyes off him. He was so beautiful. Oh, that gratified me and made me proud. I hoped he would show off some, but he didn't. He seemed only interested in being friendly and telling lies. He said he was an orphan. Oh, that made Margit pity him. The water came into her eyes. He said he had never known his mamma. She passed away while he was a young thing, and said his papa was in shattered health and had no property to speak of, in fact, none of any earthly value. But he had an uncle in business down in the tropics, and he was very well off and had a monopoly, and it was from this uncle that he drew his support. The very mention of a kind uncle was enough to remind Margaret of her own, and her eyes filled again. She said she hoped their two uncles would meet some day. It made me shudder. Philip said he hoped so, too, and that made me shudder again.
"Maybe they will," said Margaret. "Does your uncle travel much?"
"Oh, yes. He goes all about. He has business everywhere." And so they went on chatting, and poor Margaret forgot her sorrows for one little while, anyway.
It was probably the only really bright and cheery hour she had known lately. I saw she liked Philip, and I knew she would. And when he told her he was studying for the ministry, I could see that she liked him better than ever. And then, when he promised to get her admitted to jail so that she could see her uncle, that was the capstone. He said he would give the guards a little present, and she must always go in the evening, after dark, and say nothing, but just show this paper and pass in, and show it again when you come out. And he scribbled some queer marks on the paper and gave it to her, and she was ever so thankful. And right away was in a fever for the sun to go down. For in that old, cruel time, prisoners were not allowed to see their friends. And sometimes they spent years in jails without ever seeing a friendly face. I judged that the marks on the paper were an enchantment, and that the guards would not know what they were doing, nor have any memory of it afterwards. And that was indeed the way of it. Ursula put her head in the door now and said, "Supper's ready, miss." Then she saw us and looked frightened and motioned me to come to her, which I did, and she asked if we had told about the cat. I said no, and she was relieved, and said, "Please don't, for if Miss Marget knew, she would think it was an unholy cat and would send for a priest and have its gifts all purified out of it, and then there wouldn't be any more dividends." So I said we wouldn't tell, and she was satisfied. Then I was beginning to say goodbye to Marget, but Satan interrupted me and said, ever so politely, well, I don't remember just the words, but anyway, he as good as invited himself to supper, and me too. Well, of course, Marget was miserably embarrassed, for she had no reason to suppose there would be half enough for a sick bird. Ursula heard him, and she came straight into the room, not a bit pleased. At first she was astonished to see Marget looking so fresh and rosy, and she said so. Then she spoke up in her native tongue, which was Bohemian, and said, well, as I learned afterwards, "Send him away, Miss Marget. There's not victuals enough." Before Marget could speak, Satan had the word, and was talking back at Ursula in her own language, which was a surprise for her, and for her mistress, too. He said, "Didn't I see you down the road a while ago?"
"Oh, yes, sir."
"Ah, that pleases me. I see you remember." He stepped to her and whispered, "I told you it is a lucky cat. Don't be troubled. It will provide." That sponged the slate of Ursula's feelings clean of its anxieties, and a deep financial joy shone in her eyes. The cat's value was augmenting. It was getting full time for Margaret to take some sort of notice of Satan's invitation. And she did it in the best way, the honest way that was natural to her. She said she had little to offer, but that we were welcome if we would share it with her. We had supper in the kitchen, and Ursula waited at table. A small fish was in the frying pan, crisp and brown and tempting, and one could see that Margaret was not expecting such respectable food as this. Ursula brought it in, and Margaret divided it between Satan and me. declining to take any of it herself, and was beginning to say she did not care for fish today. But she did not finish the remark. It was because she noticed that another fish had appeared in the pan. Oh, she looked surprised, but did not say anything. She probably meant to inquire of Ursula about this later. There were other surprises. Flesh and game and vines and fruits. Things which had been strangers in that house lately. But Marget made no exclamations, and now even looked unsurprised, which was Satan's influence, of course. Satan talked right along, and was entertaining, and made the time pass pleasantly and cheerfully. And although he told a good many lies, it was no harm in him, for he was only an angel, and did not know any better. They do not know right from wrong. I know this because I remembered what he said about it. He got on the good side of Ursula. He praised her to Marget, confidentially, but speaking just loud enough for Ursula to hear. He said, oh, she was a fine woman, and he hoped someday to bring her and her uncle together. Very soon Ursula was mincing and simpering around in a ridiculous girly way, and smoothing out her gown and prinking herself like a foolish old hen, all the time pretending she was not hearing what Satan was saying. I was ashamed, for it showed us to be what Satan considered us, a silly race and trivial. Satan said his uncle entertained a great deal, and to have a clever woman presiding over the festivities would double the attractions of the place. But your uncle is a gentleman, isn't he? Asked Marget.
Yes, said Satan indifferently. Some even call him a prince, out of compliment. But he is not bigoted. To him, personal merit is everything. Rank is nothing. My hand was hanging down by my chair. Agnes came along and licked it. By this act, a secret was revealed. I started to say, it is all a mistake. This is just a common, ordinary cat. The hair needles on the tongue point inwards, not outwards. But the words did not come, because they couldn't. Satan smiled at me, and I understood. When it was dark, Marget took food and wine and fruit in a basket and hurried away to the jail, and Satan and I walked towards my home. I was thinking to myself that I should like to see what the inside of the jail was like. Satan overheard the thought, and the next moment we were in the jail. We were in the torture chamber, Satan said. The rack was there, and the other instruments, and there was a smoky lantern or two hanging on the walls and helping to make the place look dim and dreadful. There were people there, and executioners. But as they took no notice of us, it meant that we were invisible. A young man lay bound, and Satan said he was suspected of being a heretic, and the executioners were about to inquire into it. They asked the man to confess to the charge, and he said he could not, for it was not true. Then they drove splinter after splinter under his nails, and he shrieked with pain. Satan was not disturbed,
but I could not endure it, and had to be whisked out of there. Oh, I was faint and sick, but the fresh air revived me, and we walked to my home. I said it was a brutal thing.
No,
it was a human thing.
You should not insult the brutes by such a misuse of that word. They have not deserved it. And he went on talking like that.
It is like your paltry race, always lying, always claiming virtues which it hasn't got, always denying them to the higher animals which alone possess them. No brute ever does a cruel thing. That is a monopoly of those with a moral sense. When a brute inflicts pain, he does it innocently. It is not wrong. For him, there is no such thing as wrong. And he does not inflict pain for the pleasure of inflicting it. Only man does that. Inspired by that mongrel moral sense of his, a sense whose function is to distinguish between right and wrong, with liberty to choose which of them he will do. Now, what advantage can he get out of that? He is always choosing, and in 9 cases out of 10, he prefers the wrong. There shouldn't be any wrong. And without the moral sense, there couldn't be any. And yet, he is such an unreasoning creature that he is not able to perceive that the moral sense degrades him to the bottom layer of animated beings and is a shameful possession. Are you feeling better? Let me show you something. End of chapter 5.
Chapter 6 of The Mysterious Stranger by Mark Twain.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Read by Patrick 79.
Chapter 6. In one moment, we were in a French village. We walked through a great factory of some sort, where men and women and little children were toiling in heat and dirt and a fog of dust, and they were clothed in rags and drooped at their work, for they were worn and half-starved and weak and drowsy. And Satan said, "It is some more moral sense. The proprietors are rich and very holy. But the wage they pay these poor brothers and sisters of theirs is only enough to keep them from dropping dead with hunger. The work hours are 14 per day, winter and summer, from 6 in the morning till 8 at night. Little children and all. And they walk to and from the pigsties which they inhabit, 4 miles each way, through mud and slush, rain, snow, sleet, and storm, daily, year in and year out. They get 4 hours of sleep. They kennel together, 3 families in a room, in unimaginable filth and stench. And disease comes, and they die off like flies. Have they committed a crime, these mangy things?
No. What have they done that they are punished so? Nothing at all, except getting themselves born into your foolish race. You have seen how they treat a misdoer there in jail. Now you see how they treat the innocent and the worthy. Is your race logical? Are these ill-smelling innocents better off than that heretic? Indeed, no. His punishment is trivial compared with theirs. They broke him on the wheel and smashed him to rags and pulp after we left, and he is now dead and free of your precious race. But these poor slaves here, why, they have been dying for years, and some of them will not escape from life for years to come. It is the moral sense which teaches the factory proprietors the difference between right and wrong. You perceive the result. They think themselves better than dogs. Ah, you are such an illogical, unreasoning race. And paltry. Oh, unspeakably.
Then he dropped all seriousness and just overstrained himself, making fun of us and deriding our pride in our warlike deeds, our great heroes, our imperishable fames, our mighty kings, our ancient aristocracies, our venerable history, and laughed till it was enough to make a person sick to hear him. And finally, he sobered a little and said,
"But after all, it is not all ridiculous. There is a sort of pathos about it when one remembers how few are your days, how childish your pomps, and what shadows you are."
Presently, all things vanished suddenly from my sight, and I knew what it meant. The next moment we were walking along in our village, and down towards the river I saw the twinkling lights of the Golden Stag. Then, in the dark, I heard a joyful cry, "He's come again!"
It was Seppi Wohlmeyer. He had felt his blood leap and his spirits rise in a way that could mean only one thing, and he knew Satan was near, although it was too dark to see him. He came to us, and we walked along, and Seppi poured out his gladness like water. It was as if he were a lover and had found his sweetheart who had been lost. Seppi was a smart and animated boy, and had enthusiasm and expression, and was a contrast to Nicholas and me. He was full of the last new mystery. Now, the disappearance of Hans Opert, the village loafer. People were beginning to be curious about it, he said. He did not say anxious. Curious was the right word, and strong enough. No one had seen Hans for a couple of days. "Not since he did that brutal thing, you know," he said.
"What brutal thing?" It was Satan that asked.
"Well, he was always clubbing his dog, which is a good dog, and his only friend, and is faithful and loves him, and does no one any harm. And 2 days ago he was at it again, just for nothing, just for pleasure. And the dog was howling and begging, and Theodore and I begged too, but he threatened us and struck the dog again with all his might and knocked one of his eyes out. And he said to us, 'There, I hope you are satisfied now. That's what you have got for him by your damned meddling.' And he laughed, and heartless brute.
brute. Oh, Seppi's voice trembled with pity and anger. I guessed what Satan would say, and he said it. There is that misused word again, that shabby slander. Brutes do not act like that, but only men.
Well, it was inhuman anyway.
No, it wasn't, Seppi. It was human, quite distinctly human. It is not pleasant to hear you libel the higher animals by attributing to them dispositions which they are free from, and which are found nowhere but in the human heart. None of the higher animals is tainted with the disease called the moral sense. Purify your language, Seppi. Drop those lying phrases out. He spoke pretty sternly for him, and I was sorry I hadn't warned Seppi to be more particular about the word he used. I knew how he was feeling. He would not want to offend Satan. He would rather offend all his kin. There was an uncomfortable silence. But relief soon came, for that poor dog came along now with his eye hanging down and went straight to Satan and began to moan and mutter brokenly. And Satan began to answer in a way, and it was plain that they were talking together in dog language. We all sat down in the grass in the moonlight, for the clouds were breaking away now, and Satan took the dog's head in his lap and put the eye back in its place. And the dog was comfortable, and he wagged his tail and licked Satan's hand and looked thankful and said the same. I knew he was saying it, though I did not understand the words. Then the two talked together a bit, and Satan said,
"He says his master was drunk."
"Yes, he was," said V.
"And an hour later he fell over the precipice, there, beyond the cliff pasture."
"Oh, we know that place. It is 3 miles from here."
"And the dog has been often to the village, begging people to go there. But he was only driven away and not listened to."
Oh, we remembered it, but hadn't understood what he wanted.
He only wanted help for the man who had misused him. And he thought only of that, and has had no food nor sought any. He has watched by his master 2 nights. What do you think of your race? Is heaven reserved for it, and this dog ruled out, as your teachers tell you? Can your race add anything to this dog's stock of morals and magnanimities?"
Oh, he spoke to the creature, who jumped up eager and happy, and apparently ready for orders and impatient to execute them.
"Get some men. Go with the dog. He will show you that carrion. And take a priest along to arrange about insurance, for death is near."
With the last word he vanished, to our sorrow and disappointment. We got the men and Father Adolf, and we saw the man die. Nobody cared but the dog. He mourned in grief and licked the dead man's face, and could not be comforted. We buried him where he was, and without a coffin, for he had no money and no friend but the dog. If we had been an hour earlier, the priest would have been in time to send the poor creature to heaven, but now he was gone down into the awful fires to burn forever. It seems such a pity that in a world where so many people have difficulty to put their time
One little hour could have not been spared for this poor creature, who needed it so much, and to whom it would have made the difference between eternal joy and eternal pain. It gave an appalling idea of the value of 1 hour, and I thought I could never waste again without remorse and terror. Oh, Seppi was depressed and grieved, and said it must be so much better to be a dog and not run such awful risks. We took this one home with us and kept it for our own. Seppi had a very good thought as we were walking along, and it cheered us up and made us feel much better. He said the dog had forgiven the man that had wronged him so, and maybe God would accept that absolution. There was a very dull week now, for Satan did not come. Nothing much was going on, and we boys could not venture to go and see Margaret because the nights were moonlit, and our parents might find us out if we tried. But we came across Ursula a couple of times, taking a walk across the meadow beyond the river to air the cat, and we learned from her that things were going well. She had natty new clothes on, and bore a prosperous look. The 4 groschen a day were arriving without break, but were not being spent for food and wine and such thing. The cat attended to all that. Margaret was enduring her forsakenness and isolation fairly well, all things considered, and was cheerful, by help of Wilhelm Meidling. She spent an hour or two every night in the jail with her uncle, and had fattened him up with the cat's contributions. But she was curious to know more about Philip Traum, and hoped I would bring him again. Ursula was curious about him herself, and asked a good many questions about his uncle. It made the boys laugh, for I had told them the nonsense that Satan had been stuffing her with. She got no satisfaction out of us. Our tongues were tied. Ursula gave a small item of information. Money being plenty now, she had taken on a servant to help about the house and run errands. She tried to tell it in a commonplace, matter-of-course way, but she was so set up by it and so vain of it that her pride in it leaked out pretty plainly. It was beautiful to see her veiled delight in this grandeur. Poor old thing, but when we heard the name of the servant, we wondered if she had been altogether wise. For although we were young and often thoughtless, we had fairly good perception on some matters. This boy was Gottfried Narr, a dull, good creature with no harm in him and nothing against him personally. Still, he was under a cloud. And properly so, for it had not been 6 months since a social blight had mildewed the family. His grandmother had been burned as a witch. When that kind of malady is in the blood, it does not always come out with just one burning. Just now was not a good time for Ursula and Margaret to be having dealings with a member of such a family. For the witch terror had risen highly during the past year than it had ever reached in the memory of the oldest villagers. The mere mention of a witch was almost enough to frighten us out of our wits. This was natural enough, because of late years there were more kinds of witches than there used to be. In olden times it had been only old women. But of late years they were of all ages, even children of 8 and 9. It was getting so that anybody might turn out to be a familiar of the devil. Age and sex hadn't anything to do with it.
in our little region, we had tried to extirpate the witches. But the more of them we burned, the more of the breed rose up in their places. Once, in a school for girls only 10 miles away, the teacher found that the back of one of the girls was all red and inflamed, and they were greatly frightened, believing it to be the devil's marks. Her girl was scared and begged them not to denounce her, and said it was only fleas. But, of course, it would not do to let the matter rest there. All the girls were examined, and 11 out of the 50 were badly marked, the rest less so. A commission was appointed, but the 11 only cried for their mothers and would not confess. Then they were shut up, each by herself, in the dark, and put on black bread and water for 10 days and nights. And by that time they were haggard and wild, and their eyes were dry, and they did not cry any more, but only sat and mumbled and would not take the food.
Then one of them confessed, and said they had often ridden through the air on the broomstick to the witch's Sabbath, and in a bleak high place up in the mountains had danced and drunk and caroused with several hundred other witches and the evil one, and all had conducted themselves in a scandalous way, and had reviled the priests and blasphemed God. That is what she said.
Not in narrative form, for she was not able to remember any of the details without having them called to her mind one after another. But the commission did that, for they knew just what questions to ask, they all being written down for the use of witch commissioners 2 centuries before. They asked, "Did you do so and so?" And she always said yes, and looked weary and tired, and took no interest in it. And so when the other 10 heard that this one confessed, they confessed too, and answered yes to the questions. Then they were burned at the stake all together, which was just and right. And everybody went from all the countryside to see it. I went too. But when I saw that one of them was a bonny, sweet girl I used to play with, and looked so pitiful there, chained to the stake, and her mother crying over her and devouring her with kisses and clinging round her neck and saying, "Oh God, oh my God," it was too dreadful. And I went away. It was bitter cold weather when Gottfried's grandmother was burned. It was charged that she had cured bad headaches by kneading the person's head and neck with her fingers, as she said, but really by the devil's help, as everybody knew. They were going to examine her, but she stopped them, and confessed straight off that her power was from the devil. So they appointed to burn her next morning, early, in our market square. The officer who was to prepare the fire was the first, and prepared it. She was there next, brought by the constables, who left her and went to fetch another witch. Her family did not come with her. They might be reviled, maybe stoned, if the people were excited. I came, and I gave her an apple. She was squatting at the fire, warming herself and waiting, and her old lips and hands were blue with the cold. A stranger came next. He was a traveler, passing through. And he spoke to her gently, and, seeing nobody but me there to hear, said he was sorry for her. And he asked
if what she had confessed was true. And she said no. He looked surprised and still more sorry for her, and then asked her, "Why did you confess?" "I am old and very poor," she said, "and I work for my living. There was no way but to confess. If I hadn't, then they might have set me free. But that would ruin me, and for no one would forget that I have been suspected of being a witch. And so I would get no more work, and wherever I went they would set their dogs on me. In a little while I would starve. The fire is best. It is soon over. You have been good to me, you too, and I thank you." She snuggled closer to the fire and put out her hands to warm them. The snowflakes descended soft and still on her old gray head, and making it white and whiter. The crowd was gathering now, and an egg came flying and struck her in the eye, and broke and ran down her face. There was a laugh at that. I told Satan all about the 11 girls and the old woman once, but it did not affect him. He only said it was the human race, and what the human race did was of no consequence. And he said he had seen it made, and it was not made of clay, it was made of mud. Part of it was, anyway. I knew what he meant by that, the moral sense. He saw the thought in my head, and it tickled him and made him laugh. Then he called a bullock out of the pasture and petted it and talked with it and said, "There. He wouldn't drive children mad with hunger and fright and loneliness, and then burn them for confessing to things invented for them, which had never happened. And neither would he break the hearts of innocent, poor old women, and make them afraid to trust themselves among their own race. He would not insult them in their death agony. For he is not besmirched with the moral sense, but is as the angels are, and knows no wrong, and never does it." Oh, lovely as he was, Satan could be cruelly offensive when he chose, and he always chose when the human race was brought to his attention. He always turned his nose up at that, and never had a kind word for it. Well, as I was saying, we boys doubted if it was good time for Ursula to be hiring a member of the Narr family. Oh, we were right. When the people found it out, they were naturally indignant, and moreover, since Marget and Ursula hadn't enough to eat themselves, where was the money coming from to feed another mouth? That is what they wanted to know, and in order to find out, they stopped avoiding Gottfried and began to seek his society and have sociable conversations with him. He was pleased, not thinking any harm and not seeing the trap, and so he talked innocently along and was no discreeter than a cow. "Oh, money," he said, "they've got plenty of it. They pay me 2 groschen a week, besides my keep, and they live on the fat of the land. I can tell you, the prince himself can't beat their table." This astonishing statement was conveyed by the astrologer to Father Adolf on a Sunday morning when he was returning from Mass. He was deeply moved and said, "Oh, this must be looked into." He said there must be witchcraft at the bottom of it,
and told the villagers to resume relations with Margaret and Ursula in a private and unostentatious way, and keep both eyes open. They were told to keep their own counsel and not rouse the suspicions of the household. The villagers were at first a bit reluctant to enter such a dreadful place, but the priest said they would be under his protection while there, and no harm would come to them, particularly if they carried a trifle of holy water along and kept their beads and crosses handy. This satisfied them and made them willing to go. Envy and malice made the baser sort even eager to go. And so poor Marget began to have company again, and was as pleased as a cat. She was like most anybody else, just human, and happy in her prosperities, and not averse from showing them off a little. And she was humanly grateful to have a warm shoulder turned to her and be smiled upon by her friends and the village again. For of all the hard things to bear, to be cut by your neighbors and left in contemptuous solitude is maybe the hardest. The bars were down, and we could all go there now, and we did, our parents and all. Day after day, the cat began to strain herself. She provided the top of everything for those companies, and in abundance. Among them, many a dish and many a wine which they had not tasted before, and which they had not even heard of, except at second hand from the prince's servants. And the table there was much above ordinary, too. Margaret was troubled at times, and pursued Ursula with questions to an uncomfortable degree, but Ursula stood her ground and stuck to it that it was Providence, and said no word about the cat. Margaret knew that nothing was impossible to Providence, but she could not help having doubts that this effort was from there, though she was afraid to say so, lest disaster came of it. Witchcraft occurred to her, but she put the thought aside, for this was before Gottfried joined the household, and she knew Ursula was pious and a bitter hater of witches. By the time Gottfried arrived, Providence was established, unshakably entrenched, and getting all the gratitude. The cat made no murmur, but went on composedly, improving in style and prodigality by experience. In any community, big or little, there is always a fair proportion of people who are not malicious or unkind by nature, and who never do unkind things except when they are overmastered by fear, or when their self-interest is greatly in danger, or some such matter as that. Esseldorf had its proportion of such people, and ordinarily their good and gentle influence was felt. But these were not ordinary times, on account of the witch dread, and so we did not seem to have any gentle and compassionate heart left to speak of. Every person was frightened at an unaccountable state of things at Margaret's house, not doubting that witchcraft was at the bottom of it, and fright frenzied their reason. Naturally, there were some who pitied Margaret and Ursula for the danger that was gathering about them, but naturally they did not say so. It would not have been safe. So the others had it all their own way, and there was none to advise the ignorant girl and the foolish woman and warn them to modify their doings. We boys wanted to warn them, but we backed down when it came to the pinch,
being afraid. We found that we were not manly enough nor brave enough to do a generous action when there was a chance that it could get us into trouble. Neither of us confessed this poor spirit to the others, but did as other people would have done, dropped the subject and talked about something else. And I knew we all felt mean, eating and drinking Margaret's fine things along with those companies of spies, and petting her and complimenting her with the rest, and seeing with self-reproach how foolishly happy she was, and never saying a word to put her on her guard. And indeed, she was happy, and as proud as a princess, and so grateful to have friends again. And all of the time, these people were watching with all their eyes and reporting all they saw to Father Adolf. But he couldn't make head nor tail of the situation. There must be an enchanter somewhere on the premises, but who was it? Margaret was not seen to do any jugglery, nor was Ursula, not yet Gottfried, and still the vines and dainties never ran short, and a guest could not call for a thing and not get it. To produce these effects was usually enough with witches and enchanters. That part of it was not new. But to do it without any incantations, or even rumblings, or earthquakes, or lightnings, or apparitions, that was new, novel, wholly irregular. There was nothing in the books like this. Enchanted things were always unreal. Gold turned to dirt in an unenchanted atmosphere. Food withered away and vanished. But this test failed in the present case. The spies brought samples. Father Adolf prayed over them, exorcised them, but it did no good. They remained sound and real, yet yielded to natural decay only, and took the usual time to do it. Father Adolf was not merely puzzled, he was also exasperated, for these evidences very nearly convinced him, privately, that there was no witchcraft in the matter. It did not wholly convince him, for this could be a new kind of witchcraft. There was a way to find out as to this. If this prodigal abundance of provender was not brought in from the outside, but produced on the premises, there was witchcraft sure. End of chapter 6.
Wow.
What's up? I just bought and financed a car through Carvana in minutes.
You?
The person who agonized 4 weeks over whether to paint your walls eggshell or off-white bought and financed a car in minutes.
They made it easy.
Transparent terms, customizable down and monthly. Didn't even have to do any paperwork.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, have you checked out that spreadsheet I sent you for our dinner options?
Finance your car with Carvana and experience total control. Financing subject to credit approval.